Move over, Big Brother, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. By 2020, China hopes to give each citizen a trust score. And to do it, the government will monitor every word and every purchase online.
If you buy, like, work shoes, you could be seen as a responsible citizen and your score might go up. But if you're buying lots of video games, your score would maybe go down because people would think that you were lazy.
Also, what's it like for Americans attending a global climate conference right now?
You feel a little bit like a ghost. You know, you're wandering through, but you really just shouldn't be here.
Plus, a young Cambodian-American dancer finds out his grandmother was a dancer, too.
Wow! I feel so happy that she's like me when she was little.
That's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for being here this Thursday. It wasn't even 2 weeks ago that President Trump declared the opioid epidemic a nationwide public health emergency.
As Americans, we cannot allow this to continue. It is time to liberate our communities from this scourge of drug addiction.
Today in China, after nearly a week on the road, a tired-sounding Trump focused on one aspect of the opioid crisis.
A special emphasis will be placed on the new phenomenon, fentanyl, destroying lives by the millions. We're going to be focusing on it very strongly.
Trump made the comment alongside Chinese President Xi Jinping. Authorities believe most of the fentanyl that's ending up in the U.S. is coming from China. Many of the chemicals used to make fentanyl and other synthetic opioids are legal or simply easier to get there. Stopping the flow of these deadly drugs has been challenging. That's because a lot of it is facilitated online through the dark web, where sellers and buyers can operate anonymously. We begin today with Nathaniel Popper of the New York Times, who has been looking into this.
We've seen just dozens of these cases over the last year or two where you've had major fentanyl dealers in the United States who were getting their supply from China and buying it on the dark net.
And how does that work? Like, how hard is it for those dealers to kind of go rooting through the internet and find this stuff?
Not that hard. I mean, the trickiest part of it is frankly sort of getting it through the mail. That's where people end up getting caught. But a lot of it, kilograms and kilograms, are getting through.
How successful have U.S. authorities been in cracking down on drug dealers here who buy these substances online and then resell them?
It's clear that sort of in the middle of this year, they sort of went after a lot of people all at once. And so a lot of the largest dealers that I was tracking on the dark web and that were active in the middle of the year were arrested just all over the place, all over the country. And at the same time, they actually took down these two largest markets, Alpha Bay and Hensa Market, where, you know, there had been thousands of dealers that were offering fentanyl. And so this whole world has sort of been in turmoil since then as the users and the dealers sort of look for new places on the dark net to congregate and sell their wares.
Right. I mean, according to reporting by you and your colleagues, some of this trading, selling isn't even happening on the dark web, right?
Right. What we've seen since those takedowns earlier this summer is a number of ways in which this appears to be spreading outwards. The trade is moving to messaging apps.
Wow.
And so, you know, something like WhatsApp, which allows encrypted communication, provides an easy way for people to communicate with each other. And Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies are kind of a key part of this process. And law enforcement haven't been able to sort of step in there at all.
And the authorities in China and Asia, what do they need to be doing to crack down on producers and distributors of the stuff?
Yeah, I mean, that is certainly an interesting part of this. There really isn't an opioid problem in China. And so the Chinese government doesn't seem to take this as seriously. They're not as proactive. And so a lot of these chemicals are actually or have been legal in China. And what's interesting to see is the U.S. government will say, okay, we want you to make fentanyl illegal in China. And the Chinese government will follow through. And what's interesting is it's sort of like the Chinese dealers are following the law. They'll stop making it each time, but then they'll just make another one that wasn't mentioned in the law. And so I think that's one of the really difficult cat and mouse games here.
Yeah, I just want to ask you that final question about the politics of this. Do you have any idea of how sensitive this whole topic is for Trump and Xi Jinping to talk about? Like, do you think they can find common ground?
You would certainly think so. You would think this would be something where the Chinese government could give a little bit. There's been a lot of pushing from the U.S. government on this. You know, the State Department has made this a priority, and it hasn't worked so far. So it's going to be interesting to see how much goodwill there is for the Chinese to get proactive on this.
Nathaniel Popper with The New York Times, thanks very much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
We stay in China for this next interview, but first, a couple of background notes. Think Big Brother from Orwell's 1984, and listen to this.
That's reserved for members of our Prime Flight program. You got to be a 4.2 or over to qualify.
Oh, I'm a 4.2.
Mm-mm. I'm afraid you're actually a 4.183.
Oh, well, that's not my fault. Some woman dinged me down in the cadre. Can't you just...
I'm sorry, it won't let me book it without the correct ranking.
That's a scene from Black Mirror, the British TV show. In this episode, the characters live in a world where status and ratings dominate every aspect of their lives. It's fiction, but the Chinese government's plan to rank its citizens using a social credit system by 2020, that is real. It's kind of like a credit score system, but instead of just financial ratings, this one will also pull together a person's social interactions, political leanings, and even purchase history to give them a trust score. The idea, officially at least, is that rating people's everyday behavior will improve society and move China forward. Rachel Botsman has been doing a lot of research into this. She's the author of Who Can You Trust? How Technology Brought Us Together and Why It Might Drive Us Apart. So just describe what the social credit system could look like in 2020. How might it affect a person's daily life?
So the social credit system, and I guess we would probably call it like a national trust score, will look at different dimensions of a person's life. So things that you might expect, like whether you pay your bills on time or your mortgage, but also your purchasing patterns. It will look at things that you say on social media and whether those things conform with the government. Where it gets, I think, very 1984 is it will also look at the patterns and behaviors of your friends and your social connections as well.
I'm just curious, what kind of behavior would be suspect and bring the score down?
Well, I think there's behavior that you would expect if you make a fraudulent payment or something like that. But then there's things that are more subtle. For example, if you buy like work shoes or nappies, you could be seen as a responsible citizen and your score might go up. But if you're buying lots of video games, your score would maybe go down because people would think that you were lazy. If you happen to post something on Tiananmen Square, that's likely to negatively impact your score. This goes beyond sort of the way we think about traditional credit scores and really gets into your characters and behaviors in a way that is quite frightening.
Right. What consequences could you face for having a low score?
The part that worries me is, in fact, the penalties. Because if your trust score goes below a certain level, it could impact everything from where your children can go to school, what jobs you can apply for, the type of mortgage that you can get. Your transgressions, they will follow you forever. It is really a permanent record against your so-called trustworthiness. So your behavior could impact your children or your grandchildren for decades to come. There seems to be no limits. There seems to be no boundaries as to how far this can go.
What is the Chinese central government's justification for this?
The government's justification is both economic and social. So the reason why they're saying they need this is because just doing business in China can be hard. You know, when I interview people from China on this, they don't necessarily see this as a bad thing because many people in China do not have traditional credit scores, those sort of traditional gold standards of trust. And it's also so culturally embedded in the way that they live. So they'll say, you know, in their grandparents' generation, they knew that the Communist Party had a file on them, but they had no idea what was in that file. So this is actually the same system but digitized, but it's more transparent.
What do you see as like the really big picture implications of all this? Because it already feels like what people do online can affect them in real life. Can we trust companies and governments that collect all this data?
This particular chapter, it was one of the hardest pieces of the book to get right because it's really easy to take a Western lens. It's really easy to point our finger at China without stopping and actually saying, well, how far is this culture of surveillance from the West? you know, it sounds like completely nightmarish territory that the West would never descend into in terms of using these trust algorithms that are unfairly reductive about people. But then when you really look into the amount of data that companies are collecting and how they're using that data to get a complete picture of how we behave, where we are at any given time, what our political views are, we're not that far off. It's just the government doesn't own that data. And this was another point you hear from Chinese people, is that it isn't so far off in the West. It's just that you have no control because it's a black box system. There's a part of me that accepts that this notion of privacy is dead, and this idea that we're in control of the data that we post online and where that goes. I just think that's an ignorant position to take.
Rachel Botsman, author of Who Can You Trust? How Technology Brought Us Together and Why It Might Drive Us Apart. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
At 93, Robert Mugabe is the oldest head of state in the world. He's run Zimbabwe since the country gained independence from Great Britain in 1980. And when I say run, he's done it in ways that some describe as cruel and corrupt. Now it seems Mugabe, reluctantly, is beginning to think about his succession. More on that in a moment. Right now, let's just say Mugabe wants to make sure the world remembers his name. Today, Zimbabwe's main airport was renamed in his honor. Andrew Meldrum knows the Mugabe regime pretty well. He's assistant Africa editor with the Associated Press, and he's in Johannesburg. You've even spent time in Mugabe's prisons, Andrew. He also expelled you from the country when he didn't like your reports on state torture. Describe for us in one sentence, if you would, the character and reign of Robert Mugabe.
Oh, well, he is a very astute politician. He is a wily politician. He has outmaneuvered everybody within Zimbabwe and around Africa and even internationally.
So at 93, he's got medical issues, but he's never had a designated successor, has he?
There have been vice presidents, but it's a very perilous position to be in because he doesn't want a successor. So the vice presidents are generally elbowed aside or a trapdoor opens and they disappear.
So who are the front runners then to succeed Mugabe?
Well, he likes his wife, Grace, very much. She's more than 40 years his junior, and she has provided him with children, which he had not had surviving children, which he had not had before. And she, in the past couple of years, has taken on an increasingly more prominent role. She has become the leader of the Women's League of his ruling party, ZANU-PF, and she has been making rallies around the country, speaking about highly political and contentious issues, and she's been very outspoken, and she has become really a very prominent political figure. She, in her own words, she said, "I will keep Robert Mugabe going even if I have to carry him in a wheelbarrow to the office."
Wow.
And she has also said, and you know, I could be vice president. I could take over from him. Why not? So, you know, she's made it pretty clear.
Does she have any political experience?
Well,
From recent developments?
No, she was the receptionist at a secretarial office, and she caught Robert Mugabe's eye when he was married to his first wife, Sally, and an affair happened. And when his wife died of kidney failure, then he married Grace. And does she have political experience? Well, she's made the most of her situation. And she said, you know, people criticize me for wanting to have a dynasty. Why not? Why shouldn't we have a dynasty?
How popular is she among Zimbabweans?
She is not widely popular. She was originally known as Gucci Grace among some people for her shopping trips overseas. However, she has taken on a more political role, and she does distribute charity donations of clothes and food in rural areas. So she knows what needs to be done to try and gain popularity.
The AP's Andrew Meldrum in Johannesburg. Thank you for your time, Andrew.
Thanks.
You're with The World. Marco Werman here with The World. The Netherlands, home to one of the world's best-known pride events, a beacon of tolerance for the global LGBTQ community. That's the reputation the Dutch have. And yet, dozens of LGBTQ refugees trying to get asylum there have found themselves rejected, and they say it's because they've been told that, quote, they're not gay enough. Venetia Rainey has a story from Amsterdam.
I take a walk in a park with Shailene, It's not her real name. She tells me that she's 22 and a refugee from Uganda. Charlene doesn't want me to use her real name because she's a lesbian, and in Uganda, that can mean jail or even death.
When I discovered who I was and who I still am, I wasn't so open about it because in my country it's a crime, it's an abomination, it's a disease, it's all sorts of the worst names.
She says she was jailed without a trial after someone discovered her sexuality and turned her in. She nearly died in prison. Once she was released, she fled to Europe, ending up in the Netherlands. She applied for asylum, but 9 months later was rejected. The reason? She told immigration authorities, known locally as the IND, that she would be killed if she went back to Uganda. They accused her of lying because the official punishment in her country is life in prison, not death. They also said they didn't believe she was actually a lesbian.
They asked me about my first girlfriend, how we fell in love, because she was, at first we were friends, and then they were like, how did friendship turn into love? So that's a weird question. So some questions are a bit weird and are difficult to find answers to. And then afterwards they say, well, you didn't give us the right answers to the questions, or you were not open enough to the questions that we asked. It's unfair.
She immediately appealed the decision and had a second hearing in August. She was supposed to hear back by October 5th, but she's still waiting. Charlene's story is far from unique in the Netherlands. Protest in The Hague in early September drew dozens of affected asylum seekers. They wore T-shirts pointedly emblazoned with the words "not gay enough" in Dutch, and they handed a petition signed by thousands to the Dutch parliament, urging them to change the way they assess such applications. The IND doesn't release statistics about LGBT asylum applications, but a researcher writing a report on the issue estimates that there are a few hundred each year. How many of those are rejected is not clear, but lawyers and activists say it's happening regularly and with increasing frequency.
Well, at the moment we are almost reaching 90 cases. That's really too much.
Sandro Kortkas is head of the group LGBT Asylum Support. I meet him outside Amsterdam's courthouse, where he's a witness in a case involving an Iraqi refugee who's also fighting to convince the IND he's gay. Most of these cases involve men. Kortkas says the IND asks asylum seekers a series of questions about how they discovered that they were gay.
And in this case, they don't believe him because he can't talk about this well enough. Although we are here with his partner, where he lives together already for 1.5 years.
Kortkas spearheaded September's petition and protest. He'd like to see an overhaul of the current process and the creation of a separate appeals committee that includes psychologists and other experts.
It's a very difficult process, but still, if there are organizations who say, sorry, this is not working, we see too many LGBT refugees who get a negative, then these are the alarm bells, and then they should do something.
When approached for a comment, the IND replied by email that they, quote, give all the space an asylum seeker needs to indicate why they think they need protection in the Netherlands, adding that everyone is given the chance to appeal a negative decision. But even for LGBT refugees who have been granted asylum here, it's clear that the current process is blind to the nuances of how sexuality is expressed or explored in difficult contexts.
My best friend, he simply had pictures of a girl with him on Facebook. And they didn't understand that Jamaica was a society where it's not easy for everyone to be upfront with their sexuality. Sometimes you have to take a picture with a girl, but that doesn't mean you're straight.
That's Adrian, a 22-year-old from Jamaica, where violent homophobia is rife. He was one of the lucky ones. He received asylum within a month of arriving here 2 years ago. The crux of the issue is, how can immigration authorities test whether someone is gay or not?
Well, I don't think there's any right way to prove that anyone is gay. But there are a lot of persons who were asked very sexual questions. Like, oh, do gay people have sex? What was the experience for you? Did you enjoy it? Do you enjoy receiving sex from men? And
Quite intimate questions.
Yeah.
Do you think it's likely that many straight Jamaicans are coming here and pretending to be gay?
As I said, for even gay persons, it was really hard to convince the IND that they're gay. So I don't think it's a huge mess to come here and like say that you're gay and then you have to prove it. You have to give them your story.
Advocates say there may be a few people who lie to try to get asylum here, but it's a tiny minority. LGBT asylum support recently began a dialogue with the IND to look at ways to improve the assessment process. In the meantime, dozens of LGBT asylum seekers continue to face the threat of being sent back to a country where their own sexuality is a danger to them. For The World, Venetia Rainey, Amsterdam, The Netherlands.
Here's an update to a story we've been following here at The World. Australia's policy of sending undocumented migrants to detention camps on remote islands rather than allowing them onto the Australian mainland. Some Australians are critical of their government's hard line on immigration, and that includes several residents of Bendigo, a city in the state of Victoria, Australia.
I think a lot of them are of the opinion that Australia is in many ways this land of plenty or the lucky country that has space and resources to share with those who are in need.
That's Mark Kearney, a reporter with the Bendigo Advertiser, speaking with our colleagues at the BBC. Kearney says some in Bendigo are asking the Australian government to bend its own rules and allow one group of migrants to resettle in the community there. They're talking about 600 asylum seekers currently at a detention camp on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea. The camp's being shut down, but the migrants are refusing to move to another one.
In Bendigo, there's an organisation called Loddon Camp Aspi Multicultural Services, and essentially it's an organisation which is here to support people who've newly arrived in the community. Kate McInnes is the executive officer of that organisation. What she presents is a different view to the dissenters. People often say there's not enough jobs, there's not enough homes for this new influx. And she says that that's actually not the case, that in her experience, placing people in work, placing people in homes, that there is this availability of both space and resources and an interest from Bendigonians to welcome people to their town.
On top of that, Kearney notes that Bendigo has a history of welcoming new arrivals from other countries, thousands of them, in fact, in recent years, as part of previous refugee resettlement programs.
People from the Thai-Burmese border have arrived in Australia through resettlement programs that exist in Australia. Outside of the Thai-Burmese border, Bendigo has one of the highest population of Karen people in the world, and that's because over the last 5 to 10 years, there's been this really large amount of them come to Bendigo and stay in the vicinity.
Reporter Mark Kearney in the Australian city of Bendigo. It's still unlikely that any of the detainees from Papua New Guinea will end up there. An offer last week to resettle some of the migrants in New Zealand was turned down by Australia's prime minister. News headlines are next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A Vietnamese immigrant turned his life around after a stint in a California prison. Now he worries that each meeting with immigration officials may be his last.
It's almost like a last moment. Even holding my wife before I check in, I even text my mom. I say, I love you, Mom. Seriously.
The story of Tung Nguyen, that's ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. If you were commuting around New Delhi, India today, you had it bad. Low visibility and hazardous driving conditions. Life was only slightly better for kids because the city's schools are closed for the rest of the week.
The entire city is covered in this thick blanket of gray smog.
My BBC colleague Sanjoy Majumdar described what it was like to stand in that smog.
At this time, you'd often see a lot more people out in the streets, but there are not many people about. It's not hard to understand why. I've been out for about 10 minutes, and already my eyes are beginning to smart. My throat is burning. It's difficult to breathe because when you breathe in, you're breathing in this deadly cocktail of diesel fumes, construction dust, soot from coal-fired power plants, even smoke from burning crop stubble in the farmlands outside Delhi and beyond.
The BBC's Sanjoy Majumdar there in New Delhi. Meantime, halfway around the world, leaders from India and nearly 200 other countries are talking about how to reduce the kinds of pollution that create smog and climate change. The talks in Bonn, Germany are the next step for the Paris Climate Agreement. They're the kind of technical meetings we wouldn't normally spend a lot of time talking about on the show, but hey, it's 2017 and what's normal anymore? Our environment reporter Carolyn Beeler is here in the studio for a quick primer. Carolyn, what is the goal of these talks?
Marco, there are two sort of overarching goals here. The first is to work toward the so-called rule book for the Paris Agreement's implementation. Things like how are countries going to report their carbon emissions? How are other countries going to check in on those? That rule book needs to be completed at these talks next year, so they're going to be working hard toward that goal. Another goal is to start this dialogue about how countries are going to ratchet up their ambitions to cut carbon even further than they've already promised.
So President Trump announced in June that the U.S. is pulling out of the Paris climate deal, which is why we're paying more attention to this than usual. But the U.S. is still at these meetings in Germany, right? So what role could they be playing?
Yeah, so Trump says he wants to pull the U.S. out, but based on U.N. rules, we can't actually get out until 2020. So there is an official U.S. delegation made up mostly of career civil servants who've been at these talks before. They're expected to sort of keep their noses down and help iron out the details of this agreement. Although the U.S. has garnered a lot of attention for a talk where administration officials are going to be speaking about how fossil fuels are going to be part of the answer in climate change. But at the same time as you have this official delegation, there's also this unofficial delegation, which has been organized by California Governor Jerry Brown and former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. They've gotten a bunch of state and city leaders and business leaders together to say, we are still in, we're still committed to the goals of the Paris Agreement. So you have sort of these two different factions claiming to represent different parts of the U.S.
Well, it sounds like it's going to shape up to be an interesting meeting with some potentially fancy diplomatic footwork. The World's Carolyn Beeler, thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
We also wanted to hear what it's like for Americans who are at these talks, not someone from the official or even unofficial delegations, but just one of the thousands of interested observers who attend these talks and the side events each year. So we've got Sarah Diefendorf on Skype from the talks in Bonn. She heads up a Bay Area nonprofit that helps indigenous and disadvantaged communities deal with and prepare for climate change. What is it like being an American at this summit, Sarah?
It feels a little bit like someone who's come to the party and you've crashed it and you're afraid to open your mouth because everybody else belongs. And the minute you start talking, they're going to know you don't belong here. It feels a little ghostly almost.
It sounds weird. Does it feel like with Washington officially out of the deal, like you're speaking with any authority?
Oh, definitely not. I mean, most of the time, I don't even really want to ask a question. I'm certainly not going to offer my opinion because I'm an American. I don't really have a right to provide any input because my country's not even represented.
So what kind of reactions are you getting from other attendees, other delegates when you speak with them and then they find out you're from the States?
It's actually rather nice. They sort of smile gently and basically say, well, this will pass. We're dealing with Brexit. We're dealing with Spain. And to be honest, we're really busy here. So we look forward to when you come back, but we feel your pain.
So when you speak to attendees, what do you say to them?
We say thank you so much for not hating us. We appreciate it, you know, because you walked in the door thinking, my God, are they going to hate us? What are they going to think of us?
So, Sarah, will you continue to attend these follow-up talks to the Paris Climate Conference?
I will. You know, the U.S. is the worst emitter, but the fact remains is that the world still needs to come together. And the most amazing thing is that when you are here and you're sitting in a panel and you're watching people up on the stage and you've got someone from the Netherlands, someone from France, someone from Bangladesh, an indigenous person from the Amazon, it's an amazing experience and it's watching the world come together minus one stupid country. I can't think of anything more important on this planet right now than being here for these negotiations.
Sarah Diefendorf, head of the Environmental Finance Center West in California. She's in Bonn as an observer at the Climate Summit. The talks in Bonn continue into next week. So watch this space as we continue our coverage. Sarah, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Recently, shoppers in Istanbul, Turkey, who were buying clothes at the retailer Zara, got a surprise when they pulled some of those garments off the rack. Tags on the clothing that read, I made this item you're going to buy, but I didn't get paid for it.
İşten ayrıldığımız günden beri diğer şirketler de tabii bize tedirgin baktılar.
One Turkish worker there, featured on Change.org, explaining that ever since she quit her job, because she hadn't been paid, she's had a lot of trouble getting hired again. Jasmine Garz is our Across Women's Lives correspondent and joins us to talk about this. So what do we know about what was going on at Zara for these tags to appear with these messages?
So these tags, they were placed in collaboration with the organization Clean Clothes Campaign, which advocates against abuses. And these tags in particular were representing workers who claimed they had not been paid for their labor at a factory called Bravo Textile, where a bunch of European brands like Zara, like Mango, have been getting their clothing manufactured. And around 150 garment workers were employed in that factory. Now, in July of last year, the Bravo Textile factory shut down because the owner disappeared without paying the workers who had already made the clothing. And that clothing went on the racks at Zara. So after more than a year of negotiations between various brands, they still have not been able to come up with a plan to fully compensate these workers. These brands are offering to cover about a fourth of the amount the workers are owed. So I was able to speak to someone from Labor Behind the Label. It's a branch of the Clean Clothes Campaign. This is Dominique Moula, and she's the policy director. Here's what she told me about the lack of payment for these workers.
So the total amount is around 650,000 euros. Which, you know, it sounds quite a lot, but 650,000 euros is about less than 0.01% of Zara's net sales in the first quarter of this year. So the figure isn't a great deal, but obviously it means a great deal to these workers and their families.
Yeah, 650,000 euros, that's about $750,000. You cover women's issues for the show, Jazz. What is the connection to this story?
Right. Well, on the production side, it's very much a woman's issue. The global apparel market, it employs about 60 million people. And, you know, 68% of those workers are women. So, Marco, right now, if most of our listeners check the tag on their sweater or on their pants, it most likely reads made in China or made in Bangladesh. And Turkey also has a booming textile industry. And in these countries, the industry employs a large amount of women and in deplorable conditions.
How much responsibility is Zara taking for this? And more widely, Jazz, I mean, we know there are labor issues in garment production all over the globe, but this particular one, workers not getting paid, how big a problem is it?
Well, you know, Zara, their parent company, released a statement saying, our dealings with this factory have been clean. The fact of the matter is, this is just really symbolic of a problem that keeps on happening with these, what we call fast fashion brands. They outsource to these manufacturers and, you know, it's kind of like, well, whatever they did, it's not our problem. Mm. You know, it's the manufacturer's fault. Even, Marco, as a journalist, it is really hard to track these manufacturers, who they are. There are so many different levels. There's a lot going underground, basically.
Yeah, hard to track, but this is precisely what you are about to do, right?
Yeah. We're going to be presenting a series in early December with Across Women's Lives, and it's going to be all about the garment industry, which employs mostly women. And we're going to be bringing you stories from a sweatshop in Los Angeles, a tiny town in North Carolina, and Bangladesh.
And I expect we'll learn a lot as you make those domestic and international connections. I really can't wait to hear this. Jasmine, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Marco.
Jasmine Garz there from our Across Women's Lives desk. Thung Nguyen is one of many Vietnamese in the U.S. watching closely as President Trump travels through Asia this week. We'll get to why in a minute, but first, a little background about Thung Nguyen. He came to the U.S. from Vietnam at age 13. As a young immigrant, he fell in with a tough crowd, like teens who were shoplifting and breaking into homes. Then at age 16, Nguyen was involved in a fatal stabbing. He was tried and convicted as an adult and served 18 years in prison. But at San Quentin, Nguyen impressed officials with his positive attitude, and when a riot broke out during a prison concert in 2006, he helped protect dozens of volunteers who had been visiting the jail.
That was a very crazy moment, but I've been through the experience of prison violence, so while thinking I need to save myself, but then I took a look around and I saw there's a lot of volunteers and you can see the fear in their response of the riot. So immediately we form ourselves as a shield. It's like a fence. And we begin to huddle all the volunteers into the building.
That act of heroism earned Huynh a break. It was noticed by California Governor Jerry Brown, who praised what he called Huynh's exceptional rehabilitation. He was released from prison in 2011 and got another shot at life. One important detail, though, Huynh isn't a U.S. citizen, and since his release, he's had to check in monthly with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. That used to be a routine event for him, even though for years he had a final order of deportation that was pending. But given President Trump's crackdown on immigrants, the October ICE check-in was anything but routine for Huynh. He was, without explanation, escorted to a back office and had his picture taken, a necessary step before deportation.
It was almost like a moment of hopelessness because, I mean, I was a teenager when I committed my crimes. I did the best that I can to turn my life around for my family and for society, to amend for the wrong that I've done so that people do not fall into my path. And then to learn that the things I did as a juvenile, as a stupid kid, continue to haunt me. There's no mercy for people like me who was a teenager who make a mistake. I've been out for almost 6.5 years trying to survive. And then facing that moment when I go check in with no certainty of being able to come back out and come home with my wife, it's very challenging. You know, like the whole 2 weeks before I go to my check in, I walk around the house, look at it like the last time I'm gonna see it. I have to fix all this. I have to fix all this stuff around the house, the little things that I have to do as a person who take care of the house. And then everything that I do is almost like a last moment. Even holding my wife before I check in, I even text my mom. I say, I love you, Mom. Seriously.
It's clearly upsetting. Do you feel like Governor Brown gave you mercy and now that mercy is being taken away by Washington?
The governor made me an agent of change. And ever since he released me, I continue to make sure that his decisions stay alive. But then here comes the possibility that federal law is going to take all that away. The example that he made for society, they're going to take all that away. I commit a crime. I'm subject to being punished for my crime. I did. I paid for my crime. And I'm doing the best I can to amend it. Taking me away now, it tear apart my family, my wife, my kids. It's going to lose me and there's no income.
Tung, you may know that the U.S. and Vietnamese government have this longstanding agreement that they will not try to deport those Vietnamese people who arrived in the U.S. before 1995, even if they have deportation orders. That agreement may be up for discussion with President Trump visiting Vietnam right now. How closely are you watching the president's trip, and are you looking for any signs that might guide you?
I am very closely. At this time, all Vietnamese who have final removal orders are vulnerable to be deported. Currently, there's about 40 Vietnamese in Stewart Detention Center in Georgia pending interview with the Vietnam consulate to see whether or not Vietnam is going to issue travel documents so that they are processed for deportation. Now they are detained and being deported back to Vietnam.
So, Tung, you know and you own your story of a criminal life. You admit you were part of a murder. You're now an ex-convict. The person who died, though, did not get a second chance. Why should you get a second chance?
The person that lost his life because of my reckless action, because I was stupid, that was the reason why I am continuing this work today. Even though I cannot tell my victim for the wrong that I did to them, I'm sorry. I'm doing the best that I can.
Tung Huynh, thank you very much for sharing your story with us. We wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate it.
Tung Huynh came to the U.S. from Vietnam at age 13. He currently faces deportation. I've always been fascinated by towns and cities across the U.S. that end up being a destination for many refugees from the same country. This next story comes from such a place, and not too far from us here in Boston, Lowell, Massachusetts. A lot of Cambodian refugees have settled there, many of them survivors of the genocide carried out by the Khmer Rouge in the late 1970s. More than 1.5 million people died in that genocide, and among the people targeted were a large number of Cambodian artists and musicians. Their art mostly disappeared, but now public schools in Lowell are teaching kids about traditional Cambodian music. And for one boy named Maddox, that all led to a surprising discovery. Here's Heidi Shin with an excerpt from her podcast, The New American Songbook.
9-year-old Maddox is an amazing dancer. He's been learning about Cambodian music and dance at his public school in Lowell, Massachusetts, north of Boston. Maddox's biggest fan when it comes to Cambodian dancing is his grandmother. Her name is Lichia, or as Maddox likes to call her, Lichi. And yes, Maddox tells me, she's just as sweet as the fruit.
Who I'm sitting next to is my grandmother. Might you say hi?
Hi. How old is your grandmother?
57 now.
57 years old. Oh, that's great. Here, I'm going to
Maddox lives in a one-bedroom apartment with his grandparents, his mom, and his three brothers, plus an aunt and uncle and their baby. The day I visit, his grandmother sits on the floor with a cutting board, chopping leafy greens and spices for a Cambodian stew. Maddox picks up the remote and searches for Cambodian music videos. He fashions himself a traditional costume using bedsheets and blankets and practices his dance moves in front of the TV. Behind him, the windowsill is lined with potted plants and rows of prescription medicines.
What are these over here?
Those are my grandma's medicines that she takes. The big bottle she takes for naps. The white bottle right there, that's her allergy. So whenever she goes somewhere, she has to take that.
There are too many containers to count. Lichi's not sure what's wrong with her. She asks me to read the labels and explain, but I can't decipher them either. What we do know is this. Around 3 p.m. each day, she starts to feel dizzy and needs to lie down. And sometimes she starts to cry.
And then whenever she came, she would always cry. She was like, help me, help me. She wants to scream for her mom and dad, but they're like, they passed away. So I feel bad for her.
Like just when she's awake or when she's sleeping?
When she's awake, she cries because she doesn't know what's going to happen to her life. So I give her her medicine, she takes it, and then she kind of feels better, but in the afternoon, it bothers her again, so.
These are classic symptoms of PTSD. Later, Lichi tells me she has nightmares when she sleeps, about the day the Khmer Rouge came for her parents and took them away. She was just a teenager then. Maddox often goes with his grandmother on her doctor's visits so he can help translate. But he's just a kid, so he doesn't always understand what's going on. And he's not totally fluent in Khmer, so he uses an app to translate the words he doesn't know. He pulls out his phone to show me. We meet again a few days later, outside Maddox's school, where his grandmother waits to pick him up in the afternoon. Typically around this time, she's in pain. But on this particular day, she's feeling better. She's excited about being interviewed.
Like sometimes when she comes pick me up from school, she can't like walk, she's like limping. And then after that, when I saw her today, she was standing up straight and I was happy.
On the way home, I decide to tell Maddox something I learned earlier in the day. It's some pretty surprising news. As it turns out, Maddox isn't the only dancer in his family. His great-grandfather? He was a famous dancer for an opera troupe in Cambodia. And his grandmother, Lichi? She was a dancer, too.
He dances? Ma Aram?
Ah, you are.
Wow. So happy. I take care of her, and she dances. I'm like, I feel so happy that she's like me when she was little.
He loves you so much.
Yeah.
See, he happy.
We move to a quiet place so they can talk. This is the first time Maddox hears this part of his grandmother's story, but they struggle to communicate because of the language.
When Ma 17 did in Ma Yum Dung. How do Ma feel like when Ma Ram and Yum Ram?
I don't really understand.
You don't really understand? Oh, what are you trying to ask her?
I'm trying to ask her that. Ma, when you rom, How do Matt feel? Like, Matt feel like smile.
Yeah.
Like, she feels happy.
It's clear there's more that both sides want to say, but they don't have the words they need.
Anything else you want to ask her?
No.
Later, Lichi tells me that her father, the opera troupe dancer, he died in one of the labor camps in Cambodia. She was taken in by a foster family, and her new father, he forbid her from dancing. Lichi told me another story. One summer, they took Maddox camping to a campsite filled with Cambodian-American families. As the sun set, they started a bonfire and played Cambodian classics on the iPad. Maddox stood up and began dancing. His figure was silhouetted by the fire.
They were all cheering and clapping, and I just felt so happy. That was my most wonderful time of life.
I heard there's a campfire. Do you remember that?
Yeah. It was like I was dancing all around it.
Mm-hmm. You know what people said about you?
Well, I know my my dad's friend. They were like, yay!
Because Maddox was so unusually talented, the elders at the campsite thought he had been reincarnated, that he might be an artist or a musician lost to Cambodia's genocide, who had come back in the form of a 9-year-old boy. Maddox is delighted to hear this, that maybe a part of his great-grandfather lives on, in him. For The World, Heidi Shin, Lowell, Massachusetts.
Wow, what a sweet story. An excerpt there from the podcast, The New American Songbook, about immigrant musicians. It's produced by Heidi Shin and Ian Koss, with support from our partners here at WGBH, the Ground Truth Project, and from Mass Humanities. That'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.